Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 3 years ago today, the country was confronted with the horror of the Newtown school shooting. And then, little changed. Our own conversation in this country often feels paralyzed, but the guns blaze on. The American death rate by gun is light years beyond other developed nations. This hour on Point, some perspective from abroad on the epic scale of American gun violence and how it might be different. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is this just the way it has to be? America as the developed world's super capital of gun death? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here, 3 years ago, 3 years and a day, one day after the school shooting in Newtown, a father of a student at Sandy Hook Elementary was talking with MSNBC.
I could try to explain it, but I'm sure I would fail. There's no words that I could come up with that would even come close to describing the sheer terror of hearing that your son is in a place or your child is in a place where there's been violence. You don't know the details of that violence. You don't know the condition of your child, and you can't do anything to immediately help them or protect them. It is a powerless and terrifying experience.
And on it goes and has gone. It is not the same everywhere in the world by any means. We want to get some perspective today from abroad. Joining us first from Toronto in Canada, not so far away, is Wendy Sukier, author of The Global Gun Epidemic, from Saturday Night Specials to AK-47s. Wendy Sukier, thank you very much for being with us from Canada today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Antigua in Guatemala is Rebecca Peters of Australia. She was chair of Australia's National Coalition for Gun Control at the time of the 1996 Port Arthur massacre in Australia, when 35 people were shot dead. Her work there led to sweeping gun law reforms, including a ban on semi-automatic rifles and shotguns and a year-long buyback program that brought in and destroyed nearly 700,000 weapons in Australia. She's former director of the International Action Network on Small Arms, worked on gun laws in dozens of countries. She's currently in Guatemala with the organization Surviving Gun Violence. Rebecca Peters, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Rebecca, can you take us for a quick spin around the planet, if you'd be good enough, to remind Americans just how different the rate of gun death and gun homicide is in the United States from other developed countries?
Well, what we see across the world is that the vast majority of developed countries do permit gun ownership. People do have guns, but the rules are much stricter on who can have guns and what types of guns they can own and under what conditions. So in most developed countries, you have to prove a general reason to have guns and things like that. And the result is that rates of gun death in the U.S. are between 3 and 10 times higher than in other developed countries. And when we say developed countries, we mean Europe, Australia, Canada, Japan, Singapore, places like that.
And if we talk gun homicide, Wendy Sukier, I don't know if you follow these comparisons, but when you look at homicide, I'm looking at American rates just off the charts at a different rate than in other developed countries around the world. I mean, here, per 100,000, it's more than 3.5 in the U.S., in France, it's 0.21. In Canada, where you are, 0.38. In Australia, 0.18. Germany, 0.07 versus 3.55 in the U.S. I mean, this is just a multiple that boggles the mind.
Well, it's, I think the Canada-U.S. comparison is one of the most instructive because we are your closest neighbor. In many respects, Canada and the United States are very similar. But just, and we're one-tenth your size. So we have about 30 million people and you have 300 million or so. But just to put it in context, because sometimes the rates are not as instructive, last year in the United States, you had 11,000 gun murders. We had 131. A city like Chicago always has over 300 gun murders per year. Toronto's exactly the same size as Chicago. We had 26 gun murders last year. And if you compare homicides without guns, the rates are roughly comparable. So when we look at stabbings, beatings, all other forms of homicide, the U.S. is a bit higher than Canada on a per capita basis, but not dramatically so. Guns really make the difference.
Rebecca, you work all over the world looking at gun violence. How do people look at the United States? It's not outside the realm of what we see elsewhere if you include South Africa or Brazil or Mexico, for that matter. They have very high rates as well. But among developed countries, it's in a class of its own. What's the perspective that you hear on United States and gun violence?
Sure. I mean, if you compare the U.S. with countries like South Africa or Brazil, those other countries have higher rates. But it's kind of pathetic for the U.S. to be comparing itself with those other countries when it is the richest and in principle most developed country in the world. In other developed countries, people are puzzled. And, you know, we look at the U.S., we think, you know, people have good nutrition, they have high rates of education, half of them have master's degrees, they're so clever at solving so many problems. And yet this gun problem seems to defeat them. And every time there's an even more atrocious tragedy that happens in the U.S., around the world we think, okay, this is it. This will be the moment. This is the tragedy that will convince the U.S. to do something about its guns. And yet, as has happened in so many other countries where major tragedies have been the turning point for reform of the gun laws, but it's so far we just haven't seen it happen in the U.S. And it's a puzzle and a great disappointment to us because everyone loves America and Americans, but we wish that America valued a bit more highly the lives of its citizens.
There are few restrictions on gun ownership in the United States. Is that the fundamental difference? Is it just the prevalence of guns? There are so many here, Rebecca.
Well, it's partly I suppose that's the main thing, is that there are a lot of them, but also it's the type of guns. So, for example, most other developed countries have extremely strict rules on handguns. In some other developed countries, handguns are banned or nearly banned. And in fact, handguns are the preferred weapon of criminals. They're specifically designed for killing human beings. And handguns make the prevalence of handguns in the U.S. is a big part of the problem, not just the prevalence of guns, but specifically handguns, but also assault weapons, and just the fact that this large number of guns that is available to people who in other countries would not be able to own them. So it's the number and also the conditions and the types of guns.
We want to look at those policies. Wendy Sukio, you're right across the border, and yet just step across that border and you're into a realm where gun violence and gun death is so much dramatically lower than in the United States. What's at the heart of the difference in public policy around guns, Canada versus the U.S., Wendy?
Well, I think Rebecca pointed to one important point, and that is the prevalence of handguns. We have about 7 million firearms in Canada, but only about 500,000 of those are handguns, and handguns are very, very strictly controlled. Only 50 people in the whole country have the right to carry handguns for self-protection who are not either police officers or security guards. So very, very restrictive controls on handguns. I think the structure of our legislation is very different. New York State, Massachusetts, Hawaii, many of your states actually have gun laws that are comparable to or even better in some respects than the gun laws in Canada, but you do not have strong federal jurisdiction or consistency, and so the guns move from unregulated states to regulated states. And the other thing, quite honestly, is we have restrictions on campaign donations, and in the United States, it's no secret that the NRA exercises enormous economic and political power. In Canada, we also have parliamentary democracy where the majority party has a certain measure of discipline. So it's not possible for powerful, wealthy lobby groups to pick off individual politicians. If the prime minister says we are going to proceed with strong gun laws, they have a mechanism to bring the rest of their party along without the sort of political and more importantly, financial interference you see from the gun lobby in the United States.
We're trying to break out of the American conversation in a way here to see what we can learn from outside where rates of gun death are so much lower. 50 handguns carried by non-police in all of Canada is kind of mind-blowing to an American. Do Canadians worry about their rights and freedoms? I know you have no Second Amendment equivalent from our compared to our Constitution, but do Canadians worry that not being armed up means their rights and freedoms are vulnerable, Wendy?
The Supreme Court of Canada has been unequivocal that Canadians have no right to bear arms. And as you know, even in the United States, the right to bear arms has not been used successfully to prevent reasonable regulation. But I think that, the notion that arming for self-protection makes you safer flies in the face of the facts that there are segments of the Canadian population that will spew the same rhetoric as the NRA, but it definitely is not the dominant view. And more importantly, I think Canada embraces the values of international human rights, which clearly put a priority on freedom from fear and freedom from violence. And that is our priority more than the notion that individuals arming somehow makes society safer.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour on the third anniversary of the shooting, the massacre, at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. We're talking about gun death rates abroad and what makes them so vastly lower than in the United States. We have a kind of paralyzed or stuck conversation in this country about what to do on the rate of gun death. Let's just get some objective comparison to what's going on abroad. Look around the world. Finland, their gun homicide rate may be 10 times lower than here. France, maybe 15 times. Germany, going on, 40 times lower than here. And then you can go far lower than that if you want to look at Japan and beyond. The U.S. up in a different rank, closer to countries like Guatemala and Mexico, Brazil, than otherwise. Why is that? And what policies do you see abroad, if any, that might be useful here? Rebecca Peters of Australia is with us. She's in Antigua, Guatemala today. She's done a lot of work in Australia and beyond on guns and gun policy. Wendy Sukier is with us from just across the border in Toronto, Canada. She is author of The Global Gun Epidemic, From Saturday Night Specials to AK-47s, co-founder and president of the Coalition for Gun Control, which helped to strengthen gun laws in Canada. 800-423-8255. Our number. Wendy, I wonder about the policies that you've got in Canada, and in terms of, you mentioned handguns, so many fewer. I mean, the ratio, this just blows my mind. I don't know. You've got 50 not in the hands of police. I don't know how many handguns we have in this country. It must be hundreds of millions.
But I need to clarify, 50 people have authorizations to carry concealed handguns.
I see. Okay. Concealed
carry. We have half a million handguns in the country, and they're used for target shooting. They're part of collections and so on. But apart from police and security guards, very few people have the right to actually carry a handgun on their person for protection against other people. And as well, With handguns, it's required that you not only have strict licensing and screening, but that you have a legitimate reason for owning a handgun. And as you can tell, in Canada, the idea that civilians will carry guns to protect themselves has no basis in law.
Let's go to our listeners. They're listening very closely. Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska. Elaine, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I really appreciate your in-depth coverage of all these issues. And I think part of the problem is that we have a top-down mentality of violence. We have the largest military in the world. We spend more on our military than many other nations combined. And then we have police who are trained, at least in Omaha. I heard this directly from a policeman just recently. They're trained to actually shoot to kill, not just to wound or stop a fleeing violator of the law. So when you have the top institutions in the country shooting to kill and killing so many people, it's no wonder that people farther down the chain are following suit. So I think we have a whole mentality of violence that needs to change.
A mentality from the top down. But Elaine, a lot of gun rights advocates will say, look, this is power from the bottom up. A citizenry that has access to guns won't be rolled over by tyranny.
Well, ideologically, that might have been right back in the 1700s, but let's just look at the reality today. How many innocent people are being killed and wounded? How many people who have done nothing but be in the wrong place at the wrong time are being shot by all these guns? And I think the majority of Americans are really opposed to this wash of weapons, especially assault weapons. They should not be in anybody's hands unless they're on a battlefield. And then, as your guests have mentioned, the handguns are a huge problem. So I think we should stop letting the NRA dictate the terms and take the advice of the majority of common sense people who just don't want to, who want to be safe on the street.
Elaine, I appreciate your call. Of course, it was 3 years ago today. The country was taking on board what had happened in Newtown, Connecticut, at Sandy Hook Elementary. 20 students died there, 6 more beyond. Here was ABC's Diane Sawyer.
A searing tragedy struck in a place parents felt their children were safe. The worst grade school shooting in U.S. history.
But, you know, we've got these shootings a lot. January last year, 12-year-old boy in Roswell, New Mexico, killed 2 boys ages 11 and 13. 12-year-old killing 11 and 13-year-olds in the United States. A student here calling 911. We're in middle school. We're in the big gym. And here last week, Mark Scroggins, whose daughter worked in the building where the San Bernardino shootings took place, talked with KABC-TV.
They need to do something. This is crazy. There's just too many shootings, too much bad stuff going on here. Crazy. I mean, you hear about it, but this is insane.
It's not the same elsewhere. Michael in New Orleans. Thank you for calling, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just curious. I was recently made aware of a fairly considerable contingent of people who believe that the Sandy Hook shooting was actually a great hoax, a conspiracy put on to sort of advance the gun control agenda. I guess I was just curious to know what you and your experts think, or like what the international community sees about the sort of radicalization of gun ownership culture in the U.S.
Radicalization of gun ownership culture. Let me hold that thought and that question, Michael. I want to go first to this denial, you say, of mass killings. It's hard to deny when they're so thoroughly documented. And I want to talk with Rebecca and Wendy about the experience of their own country when it comes to mass killings. I mean, the United States isn't the only place where that happens, but it happens much more frequently here. You go all the way back to 1989, a famous massacre in Montreal. Just about this time of year, early December, December 6th, a man entered a classroom at a university in Montreal, killed 14 women before committing suicide. Here's a little sound of that.
There was utter pandemonium outside the university building as ambulances carted away the injured. Police have now confirmed 14 students dead, all women. Another dozen people were hurt, caught in a rampage that witnesses called a human hunt, with the gunman yelling, "I want women."
But that was 1989 in Canada. In the United States, we're talking about what, by one count, is a mass shooting almost every day. Has it happened in Australia? Yes. April 1996, famously, a gunman killed 35 people and wounded 23 at the Port Arthur former prison colony in Australia, a big tourist attraction there. That incident led to broad new restrictions. We'll ask Rebecca Peters about them on gun ownership.
The massacre at a major tourist attraction has shocked the nation. It had been a killing spree unparalleled in modern Australian history.
All right, Rebecca Peters, you're Australian. You were there. Australia has had this experience, but describe to us, we know what happened and did not happen after Sandy Hook in the United States. What happened after your Port Arthur massacre in 1996?
Well, after when the Port Arthur massacre happened, it was the latest. And we did used to have a mass shooting about once a year or so in Australia. Mm-hmm. But this was on a scale much larger, a scale, in fact, that everyone said this kind of thing only happens in the USA was what we thought at the time. And there had been discussion of what are we going to do about the gun laws, what are we going to do about the gun laws, but our politicians, both major parties, were reluctant to move first. Each one said, yes, it must be bipartisan, and we'll agree if the other party goes first. But because of a fear of the gun lobby, they weren't prepared to move. And what happened after Port Arthur was that the Prime Minister, who was from the Conservative Party, said, this is it, we're doing it. And he, using his position, he didn't have the legal power. The federal government can't pass a gun law in Australia, but he used his persuasion and his political power to persuade all the states and territories to change their laws to a much, much higher standard. And the laws didn't come from nowhere. We had been working with the public health community and with experts over is to develop what should be the gun laws for Australia, drawing on the experience of other countries, including the experience of Canada. And so what we and of course, public opinion was very, I mean, public opinion at that time was for a ban on all guns. We could have probably got that if we'd gone for that. But basically, within a couple of weeks, we had this agreement. And within a year, we had changed all the laws in all the states and territories and had this huge buyback, which destroyed about one in six guns in Australia, which were semi-automatic assault weapons, which the new law said there's no place for these guns in private ownership.
So
that was what happened there.
What was that total number of guns destroyed then? Something like 700,000, I think I read.
Yes, at the time, so in the first year, it was something 600 and almost 700,000 guns were destroyed. But there were then, there's been various phases over subsequent years, so that in total, about a million guns have been removed from circulation and destroyed in Australia. And it wasn't only the guns that had been prohibited by the new law. People took advantage of the opportunity to get rid of other guns that really that there was no reason to have them in society. And I suppose, and we've not had a mass shooting since then. And one of the and I don't think that is just because assault weapons were banned, because certainly the gun lobby was urging people who owned assault weapons not to hand them in. They said bury them. They said don't hand them in.
Yeah.
And because we didn't have, and obviously there's always some people who will break the law, but it was a combination, a set of measures that generally increased regulation and also a very high amount of awareness and just the horror that had occurred made people, including gun owners, become much more aware of the danger and much more vigilant about it.
Was there a perceptible change in the rate of gun violence, gun crime, gun death after this big change in gun policy in Australia?
Yes. So we're now coming up to 20 years since the changes, and the evaluation has shown that gun violence has been reduced by about half. We've not had a mass shooting since then, and we and many thousands of lives have been saved. I mean, again, as in Canada, Americans might be surprised to hear how few people die by gunshot in Australia, and that's partly because we have a small population. We're a small country, but the total number of gun deaths at the time of the changes was between 500 and 600 a year, and now it's about 200 a year.
And it's not just the absolute number, it's your rate of death is less than a tenth of that in the United States.
Exactly. The rate has dropped dramatically. And similarly, you know, we have, and the thing is, deaths are the easiest thing to measure. But you have to remember that for every gun death, there are, you know, between 3 and 10 people who are injured by gunshot. And so we've similarly seen a reduction in non-fatal and other types of crime involving guns. Deaths are just the indicator that's easiest to measure. But basically, when guns are more strictly regulated, they're less used in all types of crime.
Conversation on this in the U.S. seems almost frozen 3 years after Sandy Hook. We're looking around the world to see how things are done elsewhere. We talk about a well-regulated circumstance with guns here in the U.S. How do other people look at what that might mean? Steve in Columbia, Missouri. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I was wondering if I've heard a lot of talk about the CDC studying gun violence as a public health issue. Why can't we know the demographics of the people who are committing these mass shootings?
Well, of course, there have been restrictions on research that is permitted, or certainly funded, after opposition in Congress. So there's a lot we don't know here. But when it comes to demographics and who gets guns and who doesn't, Wendy, what about that in Canada? Can you talk about the screening that goes on, the background checks, and what's required in Canada just across the border from the U.S.?
Sure. So one of the big changes that was introduced after the Montreal massacre was to increase dramatically the screening, particularly for people who owned rifles and shotguns. And the registration of all rifles and shotguns, handguns have always been registered, as well as a ban on a broader range of semi-automatic rifles and shotguns. And the screening process, which is like the screening process in many other industrialized countries, doesn't just look at criminal record issues. It also includes a detailed questionnaire. You have to have two references, and spousal notification is included because domestic violence with firearms, violence against women with firearms, is such an area of concern. When someone applies for a firearms license in this country, their current or former spouse within the last 2 years is notified and asked if the spouse has any concerns. And in part because of that, our domestic homicides with firearms have plummeted from around well over 100 to under 30 a year now. So we've had huge impact on reducing domestic violence, huge impact on reducing suicide, robberies with firearms, and so on. It's important for you to, I think your audience, to know that two-thirds of the handgun murders in Canada are committed with guns that are sourced in the U.S. So the absence of effective gun policy in the United States doesn't just kill Americans, it kills Canadians, and it kills many people around the world.
Rebecca, where you are in Guatemala right now, they have one of the world's highest gun rates, higher than in the United States even. Is it just wide open there, gun ownership, or is it ineffective oversight? What's happening?
The law is not very good here in Guatemala, as in most Latin American countries, but also the point that Wendy made is really applicable here. I mean, the guns, the U.S., the failure to regulate guns in the U.S. Opens the door for traffickers to bring guns from the U.S. into countries where the drug trade and all kinds of criminal activity creates a big market for guns. So in Guatemala, as in other parts of Central America, there's poverty, there's corruption, there's drug trafficking, there's all kinds of things which create a market for guns. And it's definitely, but the actual availability of the guns is made available largely because of the lax controls in the U.S.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about gun death rates abroad. And what makes them so vastly lower in developed nations than here in the United States? Today is the third anniversary of the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut. There was a lot of talk about change after that. In fact, not so much. The American conversation kind of stuck. Maybe that's where people want it to be. But our death rate from guns is also stuck, and stuck very high. Look at a chart of what goes on around the world, and the U.S. bar on that graph sticks way, way, way up above Canada, Norway, Sweden, Italy, Australia, Germany, Netherlands, U.K., Singapore, Japan. No comparison. We're kind of in a class. We are in a class of our own when it comes to gun death among developed nations in this country. Wendy Sukier follows gun policy from Canada, joins us today from Toronto, co-author of The Global Gun Epidemic. Rebecca Peters is with us from Australia today. She's in Antigua, Guatemala. She was chair of Australia's National Coalition for Gun Control. They really went to work after a big mass killing there in 1996, the Port Arthur Massacre. Haven't had one since. The United States, by one count, having one almost every day. Matt in Houston, Texas. Thank you for calling, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love the show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to bring up a couple points that I thought were relevant. First, it isn't something like a policy we can change so easily like they did in Australia. This is something that's in the Constitution. It's going to take a lot more than just, you know, a simple law being passed.
Sure.
Amend the whole Constitution in general to fix it. Two, it's hard to compare the U.S. of 300 million plus people to individual countries in Europe, which have 10, 15, 20 million people, and who island nations like Australia and Canada, for that matter, because we're their only real border country, U.S., it's hard to compare them to when we have, you know, the cartels in Mexico coming up into Texas. So, you know, we have that aspect.
Yeah, but Matt, they have us to deal with. They've got the biggest gun ownership joint in the world right next door. That's not nothing.
Well, you know, also, it's not nothing, but your guest made a comment about only 50 concealed carriers in Canada.
Yep.
You know, we make a point here in Texas that there's 500,000 people with a license to carry, and Texas Department of Public Safety actually tracks the crimes committed by those people. Mm-hmm. And people with concealed handgun license are commit six times less felonies, or six times less likely to commit a felony than law enforcement officers.
Interesting.
Because we go through some of the toughest screening processes to get the license. So, you know, kind of going after people with licenses or people who legally own guns and saying, you know, that as a statistic, I don't think that's really fair, because those are people who have been proven to not commit the crime.
So you're saying, Matt, that there's not much value in
cartels.
You're saying, why compare to these other countries because the U.S. is in its own circumstances? Is that basically it?
Well, that, and I would think you'd have to group up, you know, more countries together, like almost all of Europe. You know, our population is different, demographics are different. You know, we're not as homogenized as, you know, France or Italy.
Yeah.
You know, they're pretty protected by Italy's protected by France, Switzerland, you know, Austria, you know, on their border, and then they have the Mediterranean. So, yeah.
I think we've got it. I mean, let us pick it up, Matt. I appreciate your call from Houston. I have to say, I'm looking at the chart here. If you could put all the European countries together and their gun homicide rates, it doesn't matter how you add them together, they are still drastically lower than in the United States. But I want to put it to my guests, Rebecca and Wendy, the utility of making these comparisons, given the different constitution. Now, Matt says you'd have to amend the U.S. Constitution. Well, maybe. Or maybe you'd interpret it differently. Or maybe we have different culture, we certainly have different history. I mean, is this useful, Rebecca?
Well, no one is saying that any country should do exactly what any other country is. But I mean, that's the usefulness of comparing rates per population of gun deaths is that, in fact, if you did take other countries as a whole in terms of rate per population, the gun death rate is still far, far lower than in the U.S. But yeah, no one is saying that it can be exactly duplicated, but it's impossible to believe that there's not something that the U.S. can learn from other countries, given the drastic difference in violence. And I suppose, you know, when you think about other public health problems, of course, there's cultural differences in the U.S. You know, you think about HIV or about you know, seat belts. The U.S., they say, is more anti-authoritarian, and there was a more of an objection in the U.S. to wearing seat belts. But somehow the U.S. got over that. The U.S. is more moralistic, concerned about appearing to condone sin by taking effective measures to prevent HIV. But the U.S. got over that. So it is, and it's part of a cultural change. I mean, something that an Australian government official said when we were changing our gun laws was, you know, we have some traditions in Australia. We have a strong tradition of drink driving. We have a strong tradition of domestic violence. Sometimes your traditions need to change with the times, and because you can see that your country's going to be better for it.
Wendy, what about it? Matt in Houston says different countries can't really compare.
I think Canada and the U.S. are more similar than almost any two countries in the world, and I do think you can compare. I think that the point that Rebecca made is really important. There was a history of slavery as well in the United States, and you got over it. As far as the Constitution is concerned, what's so important to continually emphasize is that while the Constitution has been used to prevent bans on guns, the Constitution has not been successfully used to prevent the regulation of guns. And what we're talking about in Canada is not a ban on gun ownership. In fact, we have one of the higher rates of gun ownership in the world, although it pales in comparison to the United States. We're talking about appropriate regulation. And the idea that regulating so-called law-abiding gun owners has no impact just flies in the face of the reality. If you look at domestic violence, if you look at problems like suicide, it's actually guns in the home that are the problem. If you look at illegal guns, every illegal gun began as a legal gun. And if you don't have an effective regime controlling legal ownership of firearms, you can't prevent the diversion of legal guns to illegal markets, whether it's in the United States, whether it's in Canada, or as the General Accounting Office in the U.S. showed, whether or not it's in Mexico. So I think it's really important to understand that regulation is not prohibition. Regulation is around reducing the risk that people who shouldn't have access to firearms will get them. And the other thing I think is so important to emphasize is if you look at public opinion, if you look at public opinion in the United States, it actually is not much different than public opinion in Canada. So if you look at background checks for gun shows and private sales, 85% of Americans support stronger controls, including 79% of Republicans, which you might not expect. If you look at laws to prevent mentally ill people from buying guns, 79% of Americans, including a vast majority of both Republicans and Democrats, support laws to prevent mentally ill people from buying guns. If you look at a federal database to track gun sales and prevent the diversion of legal guns to illegal markets, 70% of Americans support that. And if you look at a ban on assault-style weapons, 57% of Americans still support a ban on assault weapons. So the issue, I would argue, is actually not individual Americans' opinions. Individual Americans would like stronger gun laws. You have a problem, and it's the NRA.
Wendy Sukhir, please stand by there in Canada. Rebecca Peters, we're looking for some perspective from abroad on this third anniversary of the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting. Robert Spitzer joins us right now from Cortland, New York, professor, chair of political science department at the State University of New York College in Cortland, author of Guns Across America and the Politics of Gun Control. We've spoken with him before. He's got a very, very clued-in view of what's going on in this country on guns. Robert Spitzer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Do you see value in this conversation with people, whether very nearby in Canada or on the other side of the world in Australia, about gun policy abroad, or is it somehow irrelevant to the American circumstance?
No, I think there is value to making comparisons with other nations. One needs to do so carefully because there are many factors at play, historical, cultural, ideological, political, and so comparisons always need to be made with care, but there certainly are lessons to be learned, and Australia and Canada are two nations that are often compared with the United States, partly because they both have a frontier tradition, which America had. They don't have the European kind of history of feudalism in the Middle Ages. So in that respect, and of course all three of our nations were at one time under the British Empire, so there is that kind of commonality, and there is use to making such comparisons. We do have in the United States one thing different that's been discussed, which is the Second Amendment, but I would make a rather different point about the role of that.
Well, speak to that for a moment. Does the Second Amendment make these comparisons moot? Does it really cut us off from the kind of what they would see as solutions that Canada and Australia have found, or are those conceivable in some extent here in the United States under appropriate regulation?
Well, the Second Amendment is not an impediment to the kinds of changes you've been talking about today and that have been discussed in American politics, and for two reasons. The first is that from the time the Second Amendment was written up until the year 2008, the Second Amendment was interpreted as a matter of law as pertaining to a right involving only militia-eligible men serving in a government-organized and regulated militia. That's what the people who wrote the amendment said it was about. It was for military purposes, and that's how the courts interpreted it throughout the 19th and into the 20th century. Then you have a major change in 2008 when the U.S. Supreme Court says that the Second Amendment now protected a personal, individual right of citizens to own a handgun for personal self-protection in the home. However, even in that decision, the Supreme Court was very careful to say that most existing gun regulations are fine. The gun law that was struck down by the Supreme Court was a law in the nation's capital that essentially barred the possession of handguns entirely, and that, the court said, went too far. But aside from that, the idea of more strictly regulating handguns or restricting assault weapons or background checks or other things are basically up until today have been considered to be pretty much fine under the existing law. The only other thing about the Second Amendment is that it is a symbolic, it has great symbolic importance, and people reference the right to bear arms as though it applied to any time an American hand comes in contact with a firearm. But as a matter of law, that's never what it has meant.
We're talking about gun death rates abroad and what makes them so vastly lower than in the United States. Let me go to Jason, calling from Woodruff, Wisconsin. Jason, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I'll make it brief. The reason I called is two points. One, I'm kind of disappointed here listening to On Point. You guys claim to have a very unbiased way of going about your questioning. And today your panel is pretty biased. And my second point is, I'm a millennial. I served in the United States military.
Okay.
I am a legal gun owner, and I also have a concealed carry permit.
Yeah.
And the ideal that your panel's getting at, that taking away semi-automatics or assault weapons from a trained individual that could potentially protect your family while in, say, a movie theater or a school, you want to take that away? It seems asinine that you'd want. I mean, look at the statistics. How many times have cops actually prevented a crime? Then most of the time they show up after the carnage has already been done.
Well, a couple things, Jason. I mean, first of all, you raise bias, and I just have to flatly disagree with that, because I'm not – we're looking around the world, and you can look at the statistics the same as I can. They just are what they are. The gun death rates are – radically lower in other developed countries, and that's not bias. That's just a fact. So I don't know what
to
say about that.
But you're looking at countries that have, as the lady from Canada stated, it has a tenth of the population.
It doesn't matter. We're not talking the size of the population. We're talking rate per 100,000. So that's apples to apples, straight up. And with all of our guns, our death rate is way, way higher than theirs. That's just a factual thing. On the other part, I mean, I suppose people can just disagree. I don't know that I want to put my safety or my family's safety in your hands with an assault weapon in a theater. I don't want bullets flying in the theater in the first place. But I mean, I take the point. Some people see that as a path to protection. I appreciate your call, Jason. Rebecca, what about the argument that an armed citizenry can be the intervening force that actually saves people when gunfire breaks out?
I guess what our experience around the world shows that on balance, it's to have arms in the citizenry regularly.
We're losing you right there, Wendy. I've got to put that question to Wendy. I'm sorry, your line's breaking up. Wendy, same question to you.
Sorry, can you...
Yes, just the argument that you hear in the United States that an armed citizenry will be useful when gunfire breaks out in quelling it.
There's simply no evidence to support that. If arming for self-protection worked, the United States would be the safest country in the world, and it most clearly is not.
Robert, I mean, there's a pretty strong logic to that. We've got hundreds of millions of guns, and our death rate's off the chart compared to others. I don't know how many more hundreds of millions we would add to reach this hypothetical safely armed point.
Yeah, let me make a couple quick points. One is that in terms of Jason's call, we have a legitimate history of proper gun ownership and use. It's a long tradition. It's an honorable tradition, hunting, sporting.
Yes,
in 2008, the Supreme Court said that people do have a right under the Constitution to protect themselves with a handgun in the home. So that's not going away. So Jason needn't be concerned about that. In terms of something like in a public space, there was a 2012 FBI study of several hundred mass shootings to examine what happened and how were they stopped. And the study reported that more than half, in about half or a little more than half of those mass shootings, the incident ended because the shooter left the scene or stopped firing.
We're out of time right there, and I'm sorry for it, but we are. Robert Spitzer, Rebecca Peters, Wendy Sukier, thanks to you all. A little global view. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.